This is the February 13 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Matt Bennett of AgMarket.net. He's out of Windsor, Illinois. Arlen Suderman joins us from StoneX at StoneX.com in Kansas City, Missouri. And Mike Zuzlow is here from GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media, public radio for the farming world, online on demand anytime you'd like to listen to us at WILLAG.org. That's willag.org, where today you can buy your tickets for the All-Day Ag Outlook. This is our 35th annual event. We have a fantastic day planned with you. Many of our on-air analysts, Sue Martin's coming in from Iowa, and of course Mike Zuzlow will come in from Kansas. So many more, and the whole of the Farm Doc team too. In fact, I have a panel discussion set up with them in the afternoon. This is only the second time I've tried this with them. The first time was at a Farm Progress show a few years back. It's a lot of fun, and they'll be looking for a lot of questions from you all. Register today. The cost is just $40. Now, let's get a list of items from our panelists that we should take up for the day. Matt Bennett is with AgMarket.net. Matt, what's on your list?
As we get into February here, you know, we've been setting crop insurance averages. Looks like we might be a shade above last year on corn. Clearly quite a bit under on beans, and getting out and talking, I'm definitely interested to hear what the other guys think on acreage. I'll maybe let them throw a number first before I shock them with what I'm thinking, but I definitely want, you know, to take up acreage, of course. And then I'm assuming we're going to, of course, talk about some of the tariff stuff that we've got going on and what implications might be, whether we're talking, you know, Canada with the ethanol imports or whatever it might be, of course, China, but definitely want to touch on those topics.
Arlen Suderman from StoneX.
Yeah, I think it's worthy of talking about the whole soybean demand picture, and I'd start with and affect corn and other commodities as well. What are the prospects of getting a trade agreement with China? Where are we in that process? Then looking at domestic demand, we've seen a significant slowdown in the biomass diesel production. Right now, it hasn't affected crush yet too much because we have commitments on the products really lasting through this month. But as we get into March and April, it starts getting real shaky. Then I also was looking to talk about the acreage mix as well as we go into the 25 growing season.
And Mike Zuzlow from GlobalComResearch.com.
Boy, not much to add there, Todd, other than, you know, wondering if the South American weather market is over now after the WASDE report, and then maybe could it be wheat's time to shine? You know, we got to talk about wheat if it's Kansas and Mike Zuzlow Commodity Week.
Indeed. If it's Mike Zuzlow Commodity Week, we will have to talk about wheat. We'll get to that. But let's do take up the South American weather. I take it most of you saw what CONAB came out with in their numbers for the day. Not really any changes for the soybean production. However, they did raise corn production by 97 million bushels. Mike, what'd you think of those figures?
You know, I feel like that we still have some weather in this market because the corn especially can't be offset as easily with Brazil. And if you throw in on top of that CONAB report, what the Rosario Exchange gave us early Thursday morning, Todd, it would seem to me between those two sets of numbers and the WASDE report, the trade is still shaky about wondering whether we can call it on the corn weather market in South America, because Argentina could keep going down and we still are behind on the Safrinha corn in center west Brazil, likely to catch up, but still behind. I think the trade's trying to put the can in the market for soybeans. And what struck me so strongly after the WASDE numbers came out, and it really hasn't changed much since we are doing Commodity Week, is the all-time, you know, new lows in the bean-corn ratio November against December. And I think it, you know, works really well into what Matt was talking about with the acre base price. That the trade definitely wants more corn acres right now, and I'm not so sure we're not going to have enough demand for beans.
Let's do go through some of those acreage figures, and Matt wanted to shock you, so I'm going to let everybody else go first. Arlen, do you have a set of numbers you're working with either for the March figures or that you're looking through for the Ag Forum?
Well, I don't pay much attention to the Ag Forum. I don't remember the last time they ever came up with anything new that the industry didn't already know. But as I look at the March 31 estimates, I'm currently working with a 93.5 million acres of corn and on soybeans, 85 million acres. And the risk is to the upside on the corn and to the downside on soybeans. Certainly there are some people in the seed industry who are giving anecdotal stories of much higher shifts into corn, even in the core of the Midwest, where we really hate to make those shifts. I've heard those before over the last 40 years, and sometimes they pan out, sometimes they don't. But I'm hearing enough of it this time that I have to respect the fact that I may be on the low side, and so I've got an alternative in my balance sheet for 95.5 million acres.
Mike Zuzlo, if we had more corn acres, some of them could come out of those great states like Kansas and Nebraska. That could make wheat shine. What kind of numbers are you working with for acreage?
Yeah, I'm sure Matt and Arlen have some feedback on this as well, because they go everywhere. But what I'm hearing in my part of the country, and I had just gotten done doing a Zoom call with the fertilizer spray company running out of Nebraska, Kansas. And, you know, the first thing is out of their mouths when we talked was, what do you think is going to happen with tariffs? Because potash, 80-90% of our potash comes from Canada. And then they're worried about, obviously, what's going to happen between the United States and China. And with the new news on the tariffs Thursday afternoon, the President Trump may be delaying until April 1st any significant reciprocal tariffs. Does that lay the groundwork for more confidence to put in more corn acres? The second thing I'd say is a lot of the Nebraska clients, and I'd say South Dakota clients as well, very nervous about their winter wheat if they've planted it, and potentially looking at ripping it up if they can't get any more precip in the next 30, 45 days. So I'm right there with Arlen. I'm 93.5. I could go to 94. It's hard for me to go to 23, 24 of 94.9, 95 million in today's world. But that's kind of where I'm at.
And then, Matt, what kind of numbers are you using?
You know, with Mike bringing up 2 years ago, I mean, essentially 2 years ago in that high 94 range, I believe it ended up around 94.6. To me, I think that's where I kind of start, because in our part of the world in Central Illinois, we're even hearing about a few guys going a little heavier corn, but it's safe to assume a lot of your corn to beans to corn guys last year, of course, were a little bit heavy beans with 87 million acres of beans. So I feel pretty strongly that you're going to be somewhere above the 94.6. And then you start getting into, for instance, areas north of I-80. You know, I talked to a lot of growers, you know, a couple meetings that I've been to, and just asked them, are you going to plant more corn this year? And I think the overwhelming thing I keep hearing is that, you know, with $10 beans, it just does not work very well. You know, and then as long as, you know, your liquidity isn't an issue, and as long as you have access to the capital that you need, you know, a lot of these growers are saying, hey, we can raise awfully good corn. We've got quite a bit of demand in our part of the world. And, you know, I'm going to be talking about, of course, like big chunks of Iowa into the Dakotas. You know, a lot of the growers are telling us in North Dakota that they're not planting any beans. Quite frankly, I think there will be beans planted up there, but there's a handful of growers that we deal with that just aren't going to plant beans this year. So, you know, I think that you could make a run potentially at that old 96 million acre deal. I'm not saying you'll be above it, but I wouldn't be shocked if we ended up at Arlen's other number, 95.5 or greater. So at this stage of the game, you know, we're trying to run some math on like Arlen's doing, you know, a couple, three different scenarios. And clearly, I think that it starts to change things. I think it changes for soybeans as well. And that might be one of the things that maybe you can kind of tip your hat to having some support on this soybean situation with a huge corn acreage number. You know, the U.S. balance sheet might look just a little bit differently, especially on soybeans, if you go from 87 down to 82 or 3.
So here are some numbers from the FarmDoc team released on Thursday in a webinar that Gary Schnitke and Nick Paulson hosted. For soybeans, the break-even in the state of Illinois across the state on cash-rented land in the northern part of the state, $11 and a penny. On high-productivity land in the central part of the state, $11 and a nickel. And if you're in southern Illinois, $11.56. Those numbers for corn on the break-even is at $4.61 in northern Illinois for cash-rented land, $4.60 in the central part on high-productivity property, and $4.66, so not much of a range there, really, just 5 cents across the whole of the state as it's related as for a break-even. But, of course, the projected cash price going forward is not that high. USDA doesn't have one. The FarmDoc team is using $10.20 for soybeans and $4.30 for corn. So given those numbers, it would appear, Arlen, that farmers would be likely, as Mike alluded to, I think, too, to go ahead and try to put more corn acreage in. When you put those into your own accounts and you look at the supply and demand figures, is that the right thing for them to do?
Well, the right thing for them to do depends on, obviously, the cash flow of their farm. I think when we look at those higher corn numbers, we start pushing ending stocks for next year out closer to the 2 billion bushel mark, and that's certainly not bullish. I do think that the funds are going to give us some pricing opportunities, as they have, and with the potential for weather risks in Argentina, Brazil's winter corn crop, and, of course, the Midwest this coming season, where risks tend to be elevated somewhat following a La Nina winter, and we should get selling opportunities. But I'd certainly say with these higher corn numbers, I'd caution against getting all bowled up and thinking that the sky's the limit on corn prices. Certainly a weather scare could give us a good selling opportunity. On soybeans, on the other hand, if we tighten up the acreage, that helps. I think there the demand is a bigger question going forward. And even with a lower acreage, whether the demand's going to be solid enough to support prices. And there's too many unknowns there to really fully answer that question.
Mike, you talked a little bit about the corn-soy ratio. Can you bring more of that into our conversation, please?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing, I think, in dovetailing with what the other guys talked about just now, Todd, is it seems to me that producers that are looking at more corn acres are doing so because they didn't do any better than 50 or 52 bushel yield beans. And that, to me, this past year, I should say, that to me is a little bit problematic because you're making your decisions on what last year's growing season was like instead of, is this going to be more or less profitable or more or less in the hole? And the no bean dees corn ratio has always been very violent and very volatile in price action. And it wouldn't surprise me to see it whip back around in favor of the soybeans in the springtime. But I'm very nervous that putting together the HPAI and other livestock demand issues, we are going to lose domestic demand, and we're going to have to rely upon ethanol to pick that up on the domestic side. And I'm very nervous that we're not going to be able to do that. And so I feel like that you don't want to dig yourself into a big hole just because you had better yields in the corn. That's kind of what I'm counseling my producers on. And one number that I'm looking at right now and the leader to the downside because of HPAI has been the soy meal market. It has not been able to find support off of the Argentine weather, even though they're the top one or two exporter each year in meal. But that 2025 low is 287.80. The meal low ultimately right now is 292.60 as we hit the airwaves. So we're less than 10 bucks away from that. And my mindset is if we take those lows out, the soybeans could be right after it. So if you're going to plant more corn, I think you really got to be looking at the idea that the beans could lead the market down. And I just don't want to be stuck out on both commodities at this stage. I'm not answering your question on the bean corn ratio as well as I should, but I think it's more important to realize that at some point, if wheat doesn't take over and help support the corn and essentially the overall market, my opinion is the beans could lead the corn lower and it could be tough. And then it goes back to, what am I losing less on as far as break-even price and what I'm putting in terms of inputs?
Matt Bennett, because he mentioned H5N1 or high pathogenic avian influenza, HPAI, I'm wondering, because the price of eggs is so high, most people understand that there's an issue somewhere. Flocks have been decimated and they've been destroyed because this is such a detrimental disease to have within a flock that you really have to just get rid of the flock and start over. How much of an issue has this been? And Mike has outlined some of it for soybeans, bean meal, or corn for that matter, in the feed products going into the poultry flocks, which is the largest portion of the feed and residual number.
Yeah, I mean, clearly a lot of folks feel like because cattle numbers are low, feed is going to be hurt. But as you suggested, I don't think everyone understands poultry is actually consuming more feed than anything. And so we've certainly seen, a pullback in feed demand. The thing is, as far as corn's been concerned, not a whole lot has phased this corn market as far as what these funds have wanted to do, establishing their long. I mean, it's been pretty dynamic to see over the course of time since last summer, buying 650, 700,000 contracts of corn, and you only got a dollar rally. And I know that both Mike and Arlen have seen many times in the past when a much smaller fund movement would precipitate a dollar rally or drop in the market, maybe a 200,000 contract move. But essentially, you had so much old crop last year that waited around too long, so to speak. I understand why they waited. They were expecting maybe the weather market would finally develop, and it didn't. And then, of course, during the fall time frame, most growers sitting there looking at a $2 billion potential carry came in and said, hey, I'm just going to go ahead and sell corn instead of paying the minimum to get out to Jan 1. And I certainly understand why they did that. Going back to something that Mike said, I couldn't agree with him more, that I think this ratio, whenever you get into, for instance, the acreage number, if the acreage number does come in as rich as what some of us feel like it might, you could see a major, major whipsaw as far as what the ratio looks like. And I think that that's something that we can't discount. And then the last thing, again, going back to something Mike said, hey, last year we saw a major, major increase as far as demand was concerned. First quarter disappearance for corn, most that we've ever seen there in the first quarter. What happened there? Oh, the cheap corn did its job. And we unsurfaced a significant amount of demand. So for a grower to think that, hey, we're going to plant all these acres, but demand is on an uphill swing, it's just going to continue to grow, that's very problematic, in my opinion, to assume. So while I think that a lot of growers are going to kind of chase after the shiny object and go with corn acres, I'm completely on board with what Mike said. Hey, be very cautious in making assumptions that we're going to move wildly higher here. Just because the funds have established this long. And they can hold on to the long as what they want. They've done it for a long period of time in the past at times. But at the same time, whenever they do decide that this thing can't get any more bullish and that they have seen what they need to see, clearly the door is not going to be wide enough for them to get out. So my personal opinion is to be very cautious in making too many assumptions here. If you're going to plant the corn, make sure you at least cover your rear end, because there's no doubt that we could see a lot of this good fortune that we've seen over the last several weeks go away from us rather rapidly.
Arlen Suderman, have you been able to define a good fundamental reason that the funds have wanted to and have stayed long in the marketplace? Is it an inflation play or something else?
Yeah, there really has been. There's a couple of things at play. First of all, the commodity sector as a whole did recover somewhat in 2024. The one sector, the commodities that did not, was the grain and oil seeds. We saw grain and oil oilseeds lose 20.5% of value in our StoneX tracker in 2023 and another 14.5% in 2024 when the rest of the sectors were in positive territory. So we had two things happening around the turn of the calendar. One was we saw inflation expectations going up. If you look at the two-year break-even inflation rate, it went up. It's gone up almost 1.75 percentage points here in recent months. And the funds don't like to be short the commodities when that happens. And they were heavily short in the grain and oil seeds. And we did get some better fundamentals overall, particularly led by corn and by wheat. Wheat was a little bit late getting on. I think wheat does, is go back to what Mike said, have some more fun maybe to see happening there. But the funds started coming in and said, A, the grain and oilseed sector was underpriced relative to the rest of the commodity sector and underperformed relative to the rest of the markets over the last 2 years. Maybe now is the time to own them. That may or may not be right fundamentally, but that's what they were thinking. And the other thing is, with those inflation expectations going up, they particularly were looking for something to buy. And I do think that that's helping support us. That's one of the reasons soybeans have seen the scope of gains that they have. But I'd also remind us that they did the same thing last April, just as we expected they would in the second quarter of last year. And it took one headline basically from the Federal Reserve to change that attitude, and they went back to shorting again. So because it's there now doesn't mean it'll still be there down the road.
Can you put tariffs and the Trump administration into context as it's related to an inflation play, if there is one? Or it may be that you would prefer to put that in the prospects of a trade agreement with China.
Well, as we look at tariffs, they're not as inflationary as what the headlines would suggest, although it can be. It depends on how they're applied. If we look at Trump 1.0 and the tariffs we had back then, it added between 1/10 and 3/10 of a percentage point to inflation. So, yes, it adds to it, but that's not a significant factor. Now, certainly I would suggest that Trump is talking about a lot more tariffs this time around than what he did then. But I was encouraged by what came out earlier today, that the primary objective of the reciprocal tariffs is going to be to get countries to the negotiating table to reduce overall tariffs. It's regarding trade agreements. There's two reasons that he puts on tariffs. One is he likes revenue, so he's looking for something to reduce the federal deficit, which is a problem. The second is, though, to get people to the negotiating table. We saw that with Colombia, how quickly it got them to give in. He did it with Canada and with Mexico. With China, I felt like this time around with China's economy is weaker, Xi Jinping is in a weaker negotiating position. It took several years to get a trade agreement during Trump 1.0. I felt like it would be months to get this time instead of years. Then we were seeing things move much quicker on the ground in China, and they were moving, Xi Jinping and Trump were moving closer to each other at a faster pace. And I thought perhaps because of the economy, we would get an agreement quicker. And it was moving faster than what I thought, based on what we were hearing on the ground in China. But now that seems to have been cooled somewhat. And so I'm back thinking, okay, maybe I had it right the first time. We're maybe talking about 5, 6, 7, 8 months, somewhere in there, before we get some type of an agreement. Whereas they would agree to pay extra for the U.S. commodities because of a currency exchange rate that's significantly raises the cost of our commodities in order to get more favorable tariff treatment on the $450 billion worth of consumer goods that they send to the United States each year.
Okay, so Mike Zuzlow, I know you think about this in very broad terms as well. In the macroeconomic sense, corn, soybeans, wheat, and trade, how are all impacted?
It's hard to improve upon what Arlen said. I would say from my mindset, politically and historically, President Trump wants to contain China. And to add to the Colombia and the other examples that Arlen gave, look at Panama. Panama, the first country to sign into the Belt and Road Initiative in 2017. Secretary of State Rubio goes down there and says, we need help. Panama says we're out of the BRI. President Trump is working with Russia now with peace in Ukraine, and some are very unhappy with what he's opening up as far as even letting Russia back into the G7. Again, I see that as a way for him to contain China. I think his policy is he realizes how far advanced China has become economically in trade with the BRI and also the strategic and geopolitical alliances he's got. They've got set up that he has to break all those apart or weaken them substantially. So going back to commodities, if that's my assumption, if he's talking about universal tariffs, and then he's also talking about the external revenue service and tax cuts, you put those three together and all of a sudden you think, okay, he may be allowing us to have to deal with higher prices for a longer period of time, but he's going to sell that, I think, in terms of trying to give us a tax cut and saying, I'm helping you. And he's going to help the agriculture side through ethanol, and he's going to help the agriculture side probably through some other types of reciprocal tariffs, like not allowing wheat to come in from Europe, and as an example, or meal come in to Wilmington bulks, stuff like that. But you know what the trade has told us this last 2 months has been pretty simple, pretty direct. Tariff fears increase. The dollar is a safe haven. Gold's a safe haven, but the dollar is too. And we saw it this week. We're almost taking out last month's lows now in the U.S. dollar after the trade is breathing a sigh of relief on the reciprocity issue, Todd. And so if tariff fears decrease, the dollar is no longer a safe haven. It's a sell. And at the same time, we've seen the Russian ruble hit an eight-month high against the U.S. dollar. Why? Because of potential peace in Ukraine and also because of this this potential tariff easing. And so that's why I think the focus needs to come back to the wheat market again.
We'll come back to that in just a second. I want to go to the Canadian border. Matt, you spent some time up north. I know that farmers in that part of the world are particularly worried. There are a couple of things. Part of it is potash. The other part is that Canada is the number one destination for U.S. ethanol exports. They have many ethanol production facilities in the northwestern Corn Belt. How worried are they and should they be about the potential trade implications with Canada?
Well, clearly what we've seen happen, and these guys have covered the tariff situation very adequately or just way better than that, just really, really good stuff so far. But I think ultimately what I think we all need to learn here, of course, Trump likes to negotiate. I've said all along, Todd, that the threat of tariffs and the implementation of tariffs are two completely different things. And so clearly he's thrown some stuff out there just to kind of see, hey, what do these guys want to do? Do they want to play ball here? Do they want to make the adjustments that we'd like to see happen? And so there's no doubt, Todd, that people are going to be very concerned. There's no question that if we do get into a big enough spat with Canada, that the two things that are going to be of most concern, of course, is going to be ethanol, and then, as Rose referenced before, potash. And so both of those, if we get into a situation, are going to be an adverse effect to the U.S. grower, and quite concerning to me. But as far as how ethanol plants feel about it, you know, ethanol numbers have been running along really pretty good. A couple of weeks ago, we took a big step back. But overall, our grind has been fantastic. Now, I don't necessarily see a lot of upside from where we've been. It's not that margins are overwhelmingly good, but at the same time, a lot of corn was bought off the farmers' hands farther out. Typically, an ethanol plant does a really good job of locking margins in. That's been the case here this year, and I do think that their profitability is going to look a little bit better right now than what it does on the spot market. Because if you look at the spot market, you've got to look pretty hard to try to find profitability. So there's no doubt they'll be concerned. I think when they start running out of a lot of the grain that they've bought previously, I think that you could see a bit of a slowdown there. And that's why I'm concerned that increased ethanol grind might be a tough thing to come by.
Two final subjects to take up, both of which you all listed. I'll come to you in just a moment, Arlen, about biomass and diesel production, the impact on crush in maybe March and April. But first, Mike Zuzulo, can wheat manage to make a move higher?
If it doesn't, it's missing a huge opportunity. I mean, we just made a new four-month high last week, a new 2025 high last week, and we've had a lot of supportive news this week, including the USDA taking the stocks to use levels down below 2014 now. And so we're adding another year, 11, 12 years almost, that we've not been this low if you add demand to it. And because we're running out of time, I just think that the weekly export sales, the Middle East coming into markets this week, and this the issue of the Russia, the way they fed their war was through a guns and butter policy, selling oil, selling wheat. They had plentiful cheap supplies of both. That's changed. So I want to see if the fund together here and change as well, especially with the Russian wheat export price at an eight-month high now, and making many other countries competitive. And one last thing, what Matt made me think of with this great comment was a practical thing to do right now as related to Canada is, for me, I just recommended all of my clients get their spring diesel needs locked in. We're relatively low in price. We're below, just below the five-year EIA numbers. And we just use so much crude oil here in the Midwest because it's the heavy stuff for our refineries. I just think it's a great risk management. You just start there, and regardless what happens with the tariffs, just take that first step and then say, okay, I'm being proactive. I'm doing something about this.
And finally, Arlen Suderman, it's not clear how the Trump administration will manage bio-based fuels, particularly as it relates to renewable diesel, and probably the $1.25 splash as well. I'm wondering what you're thinking about biomass diesel production, whether that be renewable or FAME, and what the impact on crush in March and April might be.
Yeah, as we look at the uncertainty that we have because we don't know where the Trump administration stands, and they have such a full agenda, we don't know when we'll get around or they'll get around to telling us where they stand in implementing that policy. And so the plants, yeah, you might say the payments will be retroactive when it happens, but they can't make those decisions to lock in a profit or loss when they don't know what they're locking in. And so right now we estimate that biomass diesel production is been shut down to about 40% below what it would have been. So we've lost 40% of that production. Most of that's biodiesel production right now. The crush is maintained, and we think it's running about 90% of capacity right now because the plants did a good job of finding homes for the product they were producing through February, maybe into a little bit into March. But we anticipate if nothing changes, as Argentine supplies start coming on as we get into March and April, that we're going to start seeing a big negative impact on crush if we don't get more clarity from the Trump administration on what those subsidies are going to be. And so that's a big hit on domestic demand for soybeans if we don't get that at a time when, short of a trade agreement with China, we're going to see a big hit on export demand as well.
Let's get a final word now from each of you. Mike Zuzula, GlobalComResearch.com, out of Atchison, Kansas. I'll start with you today.
I appreciate being on with the other guys. I respect them immensely, and you do a great job, Todd. I'm going to leave it at that and see how we go here this next week or two.
Arlen Suderman from StoneX.com.
Yeah, I would say that I am more positive about agriculture than what, you know, was 6 or 8 months ago, certainly. And I think that we do have some opportunities here. But I want to keep that in perspective. I've seen many cycles in the markets over the last 40 plus years. And I still say that we're in a cycle of oversupply in general. And so that means stay defensive. Don't be going for the fences with your marketing. Keep disciplined. And I think farmers have been doing a much better job of doing that this time around. We talk about the positives that can happen. Don't just let yourself get all bowled up. Those are more meant to be take advantage of the opportunities that we see coming when they are offered.
And Matt Bennett from AgMarket.net out of Windsor, Illinois.
I just would echo what Arlen said. I think one thing I've tried to encourage growers to think about is you know, how we all felt in that late October, early November timeframe. I mean, clearly there was a lot of concern about not only 24 income, but 25 income. You got to keep perspective in this market if you're going to do a better job marketing, because typically what we usually will do is we'll get bullish as the market goes up. And unfortunately, we haven't been able to see the forest for the trees in some cases. I know a lot of corn has been sold here over the last few weeks. I think the grower is down to a much smaller level than, for instance, what they said they had as of December 1st in that January quarterly stocks report. But bottom line is, whether you're talking old corn or new, let's look at what we've gained over the last 3 or 4 months and, you know, be willing to do something about it.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world, online on demand at willag.org or in your favorite podcast applications. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Matt Bennett, Arlen Suderman, and Mike Suzalo. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.